But if I compare actually what you mentioned, like digital culture on one hand, and like, for instance, if we call it again media art, artistic projects, I think if I compare, for instance, Ars Electronica in Linz and Transmediale seems to be a lot more artistic in that sense, because Ars Electronica, on the other hand, there are a lot of projects that are just some kind of technical innovation, especially in the Museum of Ars Electronica.
Yeah.
So you have some kind of different approach to the festival.
Yeah, I mean, there's often a lot of comparisons like that between Transmediale and Ars Electronica, and of course Ars Electronica is way bigger to begin with. I mean, Ars Electronica is a huge institution that also includes this future lab, this museum of innovation, and all this kind of thing, and it is also very design and let's say technology industry oriented. So the festival, the Ars Electronica festival itself, nonetheless puts more of this focus back towards artistic creation, but has a very strong element of design culture in there, let's say applied arts as well. It's in terms of the mandate of Transmediale, we are more interested perhaps in this very specific question of the role of art within society. But even those boundaries within the, let's say, the problematic of creative industries also start to blur and become fuzzy as the art market tends to get more and more consumed by, let's say, creative industries. So there's perhaps, on the one hand, an even greater necessity to strengthen the possibilities for artistic creation within these, let's say, economic pressures of the creative industries, while at the same time, you have to engage creative and artistic work that's being done within the creative industry. So it's actually becoming a very complicated and complex issue, because a lot of the entries into the arts are coming through the creative industries, and vice versa, from the arts going into creative industries. So I would say that's one of the things that we're most interested in and concerned about at the same time with Transmediale. And certainly in the much smaller scope that we have, we don't have these long-term industry lab development types of projects. It's a bit of a different animal on some levels.
Last year's festival, like the main exhibition, was called Future Obscura.
Yeah.
And you collected, I mean, you, the curator, collected like the artist dealing with some kind of mechanisms from the past, actually, and turned them into the future.
Yeah.
And there was really some significant works, especially of the guy, Žilvanas Kempinkas.
Oh yeah.
Kempinas,
Yeah.
yes, a Lithuanian guy.
Žilvanas
I managed, I had luck. I didn't, I haven't been to Transmediale, but I've seen his solo exhibition in Vienna, in Kunsthalle.
Yeah.
And it's some kind of crucial in this sense. I mean, his installation with using tapes
Yeah.
to construct the I mean, it seems like the feeling of digital picture, which is completely analog, actually.
It's an amazing piece, and the curator was Honor Harger, who's originally from New Zealand but has been active in Europe for quite some time, and actually worked with us once on one of the Australian festivals back in the 90s. Yeah, I mean, her idea was, and I mean, she was working with us in general in the curatorial team of Transmediale, and we were looking at the problem of this word future. That now in an age where we've kind of we've achieved, we've come to the future of what we were talking about in the 20th century. The 20th century spent its whole time defining the 21st century as, this future, either utopia or dystopia. And now 10 years into it, we're there. So we kind of need another cultural vocabulary. We have to look at this term in different ways. We have to redefine what this thing means, because it doesn't work with the same mechanisms that we used before. So the artworks that were in this Future Obscura exhibition were, questioning in artistic ways some of these relationships between our perception to and with technology, and how also digital and analog media have also fused in certain ways, and how we don't have this necessity or this absolute distinction between these types of art forms. And Kempinas's work was, you know, perhaps one of the most poetic ones on this, mm-hmm. this level, because you enter a room, you know, a dark room that has this artwork at one end of it, that you hear and you see, and you think it's a projection of white noise on a screen, you know, if you just kind of step into the room and you look at it and you leave again, then, you know, that's what you leave with. But as you sort of, like, you walk a little bit more into the space, you realize, well, somehow something's a little bit strange here. The picture is too sharp. It's too good to be a projection, or it's too big for a screen. And then, you know, you get to it and you realize it's thousands of VHS tapes that have been strung out, that are lit from behind and being, you know, slightly moved by fans, there's this moment where your brain kind of makes this leap, this kind of switch between, you know, physical space and the idea of what a digital image is, and so that's the kind of thing that we were trying to play with in terms of the exhibition.
But in many works, like, if I call them again new media or intermedia works, there is some kind of a message about the, like you said, utopia or dystopia of the future. This future is coming really quickly. Like in literature or filmmaking, science fiction literature of 20th century was somehow right about the future, so about this time. But now this process is faster, so technology is developing faster. What is utopia in 2010? Maybe it will not be utopia anymore in 2015.
No, for sure not. And you know, like I said, the 20th century spent an incredible amount of its energy, you know, trying to paint a certain picture of what the 21st century will be about. And it's of course a hybrid of all these various utopian and dystopian images, and I think the time of utopia is of course gone. You know, it's a very kind of even 19th century, but definitely sort of 20th mm-hmm. century technological fantasy. So our relationship to these traditional notions of the future, let's say, they need to be in a certain way fine-tuned. You know, in my perspective, I was saying during the festival on some occasions that the future ended when we put man on the moon. So we kind of did it. We got there, and it's done. You know, the computers that were used to do that, okay, there's the same things that, you know, are in here, but, you know, they're just a bit smaller, faster, work a little bit differently. And of course, you know, probably 1 year, you know, people will walk on Mars, but so what? So we can imagine that it's not part of a sort of like a fantasy, you know, fiction that may or may not be part of our future. We could even imagine, you know, warp speed space travel. Science fiction is of course always there, and we have these images of technology and progress, but it's become part of our understanding that it may or may not be. It's not necessarily a global aspiration. So it could be that our global aspirations of what utopia is or what future is about are maybe much more simple, and maybe not so much tied to technology, and maybe, you know, even kinds of banal things that, you know, we'll actually be able to feed each other or feed ourselves in 50 mm-hmm. years or something like that, and that's what we were trying to get at the festival, that this traditional link between technology and progress is not necessarily the same anymore, and we have to look at these things in completely different type of metaphors, perhaps.
It seems, or it seemed like maybe the utopia also of 20th century was that technology will help with development of the world economy, of with the developing of the society. But it seems that it doesn't happening. Technology is in its is serving the economy. It seems like.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was always an important part of the scenario, and I mean, of course. Development and economic development are important things. I mean, people have to live and make money and all that kind of thing. We're not Luddists or against economic development, but and I think that technology is still important in terms of creating you know, the kinds of open societies and open systems of expression. And of course, it's always an interesting discussion, you know, to think about, well, what would the 80s have been like if the internet was as advanced as it was, as it became in the 90s, if that would have changed, you know, the way the government apparatus was working. I mean, we're seeing this kind of thing happen in China, of course, which is a classic example of the struggle of governments with and against technologies. So, in a sense, maybe it is actually the era of technology more than any other, because we are all users of it. Earlier, technology was something that was left up to the scientists, for example. Maybe it is actually now the technological age, because all of society finally actually understands what this stuff is and knows how to use it. It's not a remote domain that is let's say exclusively for the sciences or for research institutes or geeks or something. But it is our daily vocabulary, and that also has an effect, you know, on the way things will be in the future, whatever the future is.
But it's not affordable probably still for all the people, not even in Europe probably. I mean, internet is not for free, actually. Maybe there are some examples in some countries.
But it's not just internet, it's the pervasivity of technology in all aspects of life. And this exists also in contexts of developing countries as well. You know, the mobile phone, the notion of knowing what internet is, even if you don't have access to it, you know, what you can do with it, the way television is now brought into communities and other places. So even if, let's say, worst case scenario, you don't actually have that stuff or the direct access to it, and of course we work with the mechanisms that we have to create ways of access for everybody to get into these systems, is that, you know, they are there. I mean, our grandparents are even using this stuff, which is quite incredible. You know?
So, what are the main methods of archiving, I would say, some media or even ephemeral pieces of art?
Yeah, that's probably the most difficult thing to deal with, because, of course, with Transitland is very straightforward. We're looking at a certain kind of medium. It's usually video. We digitize them. It's done. Mm-hmm. But when I worked at V2 in Rotterdam, the Institute for the Unstable Media, we started a project to devise exactly this kind of methodology, because how do you create an archive of a process-based performance or something which uses fire and solenoids? Do you just, you know, record what you see, or do you try to archive the actual essence and in a sense that you would be able to reconstitute or recreate the art piece itself? You know, those are really tricky fundamental questions. So a project was born that included V2, the Langlois Foundation, I think the ZKM, to create this kind of methodology that could be actually applied to every conceivable type of technology-based, unstable, or digital kind of artistic production by breaking it down into its most fundamental elements. Mm-hmm. And you know, looking at that in the sense of, I think, the project, which was called Capturing Unstable Media, set out a methodology which broke down any kind of artistic process that was related to technology into sort of 30 basic components that can range from, I don't know, text to DC voltage. Mm-hmm. And established an archival structure and methodology to quantify and classify and capture each one of these elements, so that at a later time you could take those elements, take them out, rebuild them, and, you know, recreate that artwork. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's partly a theoretical methodology, because it relates to, let's say, the process of how to capture something. I mean, so if that 3D mm-hmm. printer was the artwork, of course you could just stick it in a room somewhere and cross your fingers and hope that 20 years from now you can turn it on and it'll run. But it could be that, you know, we use a different kind of electrical system, or, you know, other components that are required to make that thing function are going to change. So even with something as simple as that, there's a necessity to break down its elements into, you know, kind of standardized pieces that can be reestablished. In the case of Transmediale, we have also a huge physical archive of over 20 years of artworks, but also documentations of artworks, screening copies and preview copies, audio tapes. And there is no real consensus on how to, let's say, scientifically deal with this broad range of different kinds of media, and to put it into a system that is also universally accessible. Because with an archive system, we also want to have a certain form of universal accessibility, so that you can share the knowledge. Because mm-hmm. that's one of the main tasks of it. So one of the questions that I have actually tonight is, well, how do we do this? Because I don't really know. And I mean, I'm not an archival expert anyways myself. I just have to deal with them all mm-hmm. the time. And both for the archive of Ostrenenia and for the archive of Transmediale, I'm looking to find, you know, best means and methods to actually capture this stuff, so that we can actually make it into, you know, at least a research resource.
But the purpose of archiving like complex process or ephemeral art pieces, it's, what is the purpose? It's not to keep this, if I go back to Benjamin, aura of the yeah, artwork, probably.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, for some people it is, but of course it is also about establishing cultural and social histories. I mm-hmm. mean, of course it is, you know, the way we understand who we are and where we come from is based on all different forms of archiving, whether it's encyclopedic knowledge or word of mouth or philosophy. And a lot of us who have been dealing with electronic media over the past 20 or 30 years were a little bit upset or depressed or frustrated by the lack of, let's say, seriousness within structures and communities that develop the canons of historical knowledge, and deal less with, let's say, these ephemeral media. There are very strict and very well researched histories of contemporary art, mm-hmm. And this is not quite the same scenario within the so-called media and electronic arts, and probably because, in a certain sense, the market value or the marketableness of the art form that we deal with is very difficult to pin down, and the art form changes radically sometimes from one day to the next. So it's not the same as a fixed sculpture or painting or something, which is easy to catalog, and you can look at it in a lot of different contexts, and find a kind of a commonality with a lot of the electronic media work that we look at. Each time we look at it, we see something different. It changes its form. So there needs to be ways of giving value to these means of transformation also within the artwork. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the necessary values of doing these archival projects is to establish let's say that historical relevance that these artworks have. So the Diva project and the Gamma project are fantastic. I mean, I'm hoping that we can get some of the work from Transmediale into that, because it starts to develop these languages that go from project to project, from history to history, from institution to institution. It starts putting them together, and within the context of a festival which produces so much material and creates so much debate and creates so much, let's say, history through its own trajectory, there's very little focus and resources given to also capturing that specific mm-hmm. history. It's much more so within the mainstream contemporary art world. And again, it has to do with, I guess, the market value of the artwork. But of course, we feel that this artwork that we deal with is just as, if not more, valuable.
In the terms of art market, like, something similar happened probably to the conceptual art. This art was also based on actions. It was ephemeral,
sure,
somehow, and it was documented usually in video, film, or photography. And after, let's say, 20 years, all those documents became valuable pieces of art.
Yeah.
Do you think it will happen also to media art?
Well, it does in a certain sense, but I think the primary difference there is that in the case of the art that you're referring to, and I mean there's some great Slovene movements as well, or mm-hmm. OHO group and that, where exactly it's those documents of the actions which have become valuable. Within the medium that we're working at, the documentation is often the thing itself. The technology and the means of looking at the things are more melted together, and the means of documentation are much more complex and complicated. You know, it's not enough to just videotape an action or something. I mean, how do you record a work of digital code? It's become a much more complex thing. So one of the main, let's say, movements is towards creating documentation as emulation, to be able to find ways to have this recreation, and that the machines and the mechanisms that do that somehow also sometimes become that art piece themselves. It's not quite the same scenario. I mean, of course, you can record performances, but I think the capital within that recording is much less than it was in those times when the technology was being used really for that specific purpose.